In the Great Hall of the Justice League, there are assembled the world's four greatest heroes, created from the cosmic legends of the universe. Superman. Wonder Woman. Batman. Aquaman. And those three junior super friends, Wendy, Marvin, and Wonder Dog. Their mission, to fight injustice, to right that which is wrong, and to serve all mankind.
Hello, and welcome to another exciting episode of For All Mankind, a Super Friends podcast. For All Mankind is a read-through show covering DC Comics' classic Super Friends series, which ran for 47 issues from 1976 to 1981. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And joining me this episode is my super friend, Dr. Chris Lewis. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Rob. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you for joining me here in the Hall of Justice.
Thank you. Well, we've done a lot of movie talk and we've done some MASH episodes. And
Bob Dylan, too. We've done
we've
that,
even
too.
Improbably done not one, but two Bob Dylan podcasts. And again, Dylan fans, I can only apologize for my part in those shows. But you and I have never podcasted about DC Comics. So it's really great to be here.
Have we? Really? We've not to this point?
No.
That's amazing. Wow. Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, it's high time that we finally get to this. And this is your, let's see, how close are you to a Robbie now, right? Because you've been on Pod Dylan. You've been on Film and Water.
Yeah.
You've been on MASH.
This is the fourth.
So this is four. Okay. Well, you got to do one more after this, and then you've got the coveted Robbie. So that's exciting. So anyway,
I'll make a place on my lapel for the medal.
Right next to the Caduceus. So we're, we're here to talk about Super Friends number 41. It was on sale November 25th, 1980. There are two stories in this comic. Luckily, neither one of them is Jack O'Lantern. But before we get to all that, Chris, this is your first time on the show. Do you have any particular history with this comic? Did Super Friends make it to your neck of the woods while it was still being published?
Super Friends comic, I have zero experience with. Super Friends cartoon, I have almost zero experience with. So, comics, my parents, when we were growing up, they were really keen on us reading, didn't think comics were very worth reading at all, very lowbrow. And so we weren't really kind of encouraged, coupled with American comics were incredibly difficult to get hold of. And there was really only one place I knew of where you could get DC comics reliably. And that's when we traveled to my grandparents. And halfway between our house and theirs, there was a service station. I guess you would call a truck stop somewhere off the M40 just outside of Oxford. And they had the usual, you know, canteen and restrooms, and they had a tiny little newsagent. And for some reason, they had a few DC comics. No idea why. Super Friends wasn't one of them, but I would go for Green Lantern. My brother would go for Flash. And so Green Lantern 175, written by Len Wein, drawn by Dave Gibbons. Green Lantern versus the Shark, featuring the Flash and Rainbow Raider. That was my first ever DC comic. And A1 creative team, absolutely Z-list villains. which may explain why I like Ultra the Multi-Alien quite so much. But there we go. So my equivalent of your mountain comics is Truck Stop off the M40 comics. And I think that lacks a little romance in its soul, if I'm quite honest, Rob. The Super Friends cartoon, I saw very tiny bits of because it was shown early on a Saturday morning on London weekend television. But I had piano lessons, so I would get to see like 3 to 5 minutes of the start, and then I would be whisked away into my lesson. But the character that made the biggest impact on me, I think, was Aquaman. Because
now you're speaking my language.
Yeah, because Superman I knew from the movie. Wonder Woman, we had the Linda Carter series, Batman, you know, the what we now call Batman 66. I'd seen all of those characters, but Aquaman was completely new. And so the second DC comic that I ever had was Aquaman from that Keith Giffen, Robert Lauren Fleming.
Oh, the miniseries.
One miniseries, yeah. A middle issue, like three or four, I can't quite remember. So I had this tiny little bit of Super Friends, but it was a huge seed from which everything then, you know, all of my love for DC Comics then grew, which is interesting, isn't it? Because comics are such a, cartoons are such a gateway to the comics, for many people. And, you know, you hope that kind of Teen Titans Go does that for the new generation. And there's probably others now, but I'm too old for those.
Were there many American cartoons that made it over to England at all, or not? Oh, or sure. Not like it wasn't that Super Friends was unique. It was weren't American cartoons, period.
No, I mean, all those Hanna-Barbera ones came across, you know, Scooby-Doo and all those kind of ones, and Tom and Jerry and the kind of real back to the 40s and 50s kind of cartoons. I think they were quite beloved of UK programmers actually, because it sort of filled a little slot. You know, if you had 5 minutes somewhere, you know, your show ended and you had a 5 minute gap, they just bunged one in before the news broadcast or something like that.
Really?
So yeah. Oh yeah. That was a real thing, Rob. Yeah. No, you know,
I'm trying to imagine like running a Tom and Jerry cartoon before the news.
Yeah. No, that was the thing. Well, quite often the kids programs in the afternoon sort of would start when kids came home from school and they'd run up to kind of.
Sure. Of course. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Then one of the main evening news broadcasts over here is 6 p.m. And so quite often they'd have a tiny little gap that they just have to fill before you went into, you know, the economy's crashing or, you know, 3 day week.
What's Margaret Thatcher doing now?
IRA bombing, you know, all that. You know, what could be more fun than Tom and Jerry, a droopy cartoon?
I love that idea of a droopy cartoon leaning into the serious news of the 1980s. That's fantastic. Okay. And now the news. So that's a terrible droopy impersonation. So, okay, well, we're going to have to get you on Mountain Comics then at some point to talk about your gas station comics, because that's okay, that's a whole separate thing. We got to spring way to another whole show. So, all right, excellent. Well, that's great. So, okay. So is this the first Super Friends comic then you've ever read, this one?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
I mean, in you know, apart from dipping in when I've listened to your show and kind of gone, that sounds interesting.
So right.
The app, what's it called? Infinite Universe DC Comics.
Gotcha.
Arrange those words into the right name. But yeah, basically, yes.
All right, cool. I'm interested to find out what you thought of this one. So as I mentioned, it's Super Friends number 41. The story is the Toy Man's tricky thefts. Before I get to the plot synopsis, I want to ask you, of course, Chris, what do you think of this cover by Ramona Freyden and Bob Smith?
It's a classic. I looked the name up. It's a mirrored confrontation shot, according to TV Tropes. Basically, you've got the heroes coming in from the left, the villains coming in from the right. They're about a millisecond from colliding in the middle in a fight. And I rather like it, actually. I mean, it's how many of these covers? There must have been thousands of comic covers like this, mustn't there, over the years?
Oh, yeah.
Toy Man standing in the middle. He's got a pop gun and he's shouting the words, "Let the battle begin." And then at the bottom, and here's your entrance fee, everybody, the Seraph. 1981 Seraph is DC Comics breakout character for 2023. The man who can work miracles. Yeah.
Yeah, I love these covers. As I've said before, anytime, it's either two different covers I love. One, superheroes doing something social. You know, like them, like playing with kids for Christmas or delivering toys or building like a statue, some sort of thing. Or this one, like this, you know, reminiscent of number 28 where they faced off against the monsters. So you've got the characters on one side, characters on the other, and they're about to smack into each other. That has to be the DNA from that has to be from that opening credits, the Challenge of the Super Friends, where the heroes are running from the left, the villains are running from the right. They smash into each other, and there's the title of the show. I mean, it's a can't lose cover design to do, you know. So we got the Toy Man, and got these five characters that are kind of just represented from figures from history. There's like a knight, a pirate, like a Native American, a spaceman, and a cowboy, and then we've got Batman, Superman. I love that Batman has got his one arm out. I don't know what symmetry. He's doing exactly, but
the symmetry is really good. Look, Batman's got his arm out. The cowboy's got his gun pointing at Batman. Right. Superman's got both arms out flying in classic pose. The spaceman's got both arms out holding a ray gun. The Robin's punching the air as he runs. The Native American that he's got, he's against, is punching the air, holding a tomahawk. It's really, really symmetrical. And I love that. It's so mirrored. It's great.
Yeah. I mean, nobody beats Ramona Freyden. And we have to mention, for this story that she drew, this is her last issue on Super Friends. She would continue to do the covers all the way till the end of the book, which is number 47. But this is her final issue as the penciler of the main story. Okay. So we'll be talking a little bit more about Ramona later on in the show. So anyway, the story, as I mentioned, is called The Toy Man's Tricky Thefts by Ian B., of course, Ramona Freyden, as I just mentioned, and Vince Coletta. We open on the Toy Man escaping from prison with the help of some life-size toy soldiers who seemingly give their lives so their master can get away. The next day, at the Gotham Toy Fair, the Toy Man appears and tries to steal all the toys on display. Unfortunately for him, Xan and Jaina are in attendance in their civilian guises. They transform into a thundercloud and an Exorian shellback and make quick work of the Toy Man and his henchmen. Or do they? Downstairs, another Toy Man is committing a similar robbery and then gets away. In the papers the next day, it's revealed that the Wonder Twins captured a decoy Toy Man. Batman, Aquaman, and Wonder Woman are critical of the Wonder Twins for them not noticing that their Toy Man was a fake, but Robin is more sympathetic. The next day at the Toy Fair, a box of toys arrive, including a talking Toy Man doll who issues a warning to the Super Friends. He is going to commit another toy-based crime the next day, and he challenges them to stop him. Robin deduces that this could mean a few things: a rock concert featuring a group called Jack in the Box, or a puppet group called the Mop Heads filming a TV special. The Super Friends agree to break up and cover both events, leaving Robin to stay behind and look after the Wonder Twins, an assignment he is none too excited about. Indeed, the Toy Man attempts to steal items from both events, but are stopped by the teams of Superman and Aquaman and Batman and Wonder Woman. But all four Super Friends see that the perpetrators are merely remote-controlled units, meaning no one has captured the Toy Man. The real Toy Man is busy stealing toys donated by the Wayne Foundation to the Gotham Orphanage. What a dick. Luckily, Robin and the Wonder Twins are there and fight off Toy Man's toy-themed goons while he escapes. Or does he? Jaina turns into a hunting dog and uses her heightened sense of smell, discovers Toy Man hiding in a crate like the little weasel he is. The Super Friends are reunited, and Batman jokes that it was Robin who sent the old heroes off on wild goose chases so he and the Wonder Twins could catch Toy Man. The Wonder Twins respond that Robin is free to team up with them anytime. So, okay. All right, Chris.
Done. Yeah. That is that. It's such a dense plot. It jumps all over the place.
These EMB plot synopses are not easy. I will say, I will miss doing this show when it wraps up. I will not miss the plot synopses because it's a lot of writing. EMB gives you your 50 cents worth for a 17-page story.
Now, I want to check. The credit book says Bob Razakis, guest writer. Is that right for this one?
You know what? Oh, wow. I'm embarrassed to say I did not even notice that. I was so sure the EMB wrote it. I didn't even notice that. Well, that's embarrassing. I didn't even look at the credits. I wouldn't think to because EMB's written pretty much every issue except for like one or two in the early run.
Okay. Cause I was going to ask you about this later. Cause I have issues with the characterization of Batman and Wonder Woman and the way they deal with the young heroes in particular, but we'll come to that. And I was going to ask you if that was a Bob Razakis thing, but
okay. I'm so embarrassed that I didn't even bother to look. I just, you know, cause other than like two issues written by Denny O'Neill around like number 10 and 11, EMB has written every single issue. So I was just like, all right, he just wrote this one too. I didn't even think that's it. Oh boy. I'm hanging my head in shame here, Chris, that I made that mistake, but thank you for pointing that out. So, anyway, Bob Razakis in this case is giving you a lot for your 50 cents for the 17 pages here.
This in modern comics, this is like a year's worth of issues. This
really would be. Really would be.
So much, and it jumps about so much.
So again, as I mentioned, it opens up with this splash page, and that leads into the second page of the story where the Toy Man is using these toy soldiers to sacrifice their lives, as it were, so he can escape. And, you know, he breaks out and the guards are like, where did he go? And he just smashes out. So, you know, there's something about, first of all, you've got the toy soldiers are actually shooting guns.
Yeah. Now I want to check in with you this because, you know, you guys have slightly more relaxed gun laws than we do over here. Is it okay for an inmate to have an actual cannon? Can I just check on that? Is that a thing that's okay? Is the NRA kind of asking for this? You know, because everybody is packing heat here.
I don't even want to go down that road in this. You know, I don't know.
And it's not a toy cannon. It is an actual real size Civil War heavy artillery cannon to blow a hole in the prison wall. It's amazingly powerful. And there's no explanation how it got there. And I think this prison really needs to review its security protocols.
You do wonder where he got this from. Because, yeah, you're right. It is like a old-timey cannon. And again, these toy soldiers have actual guns that they're firing at the guards and stuff. So, yeah, really, it's a pretty heavily armed gunfight here.
Yeah. And the soldiers are robots. We see that because all are they kind of puppets? Because on the next page, one of them throws itself in front of the guards who are firing at the escaping toy man. And it kind of bursts apart and it's all kind of on springs and cords and stuff. So these are robots, which I guess fits with the toy man theme, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So toy man escapes. And then we got to this Gotham Museum toy fair, which is all filled with kind of crazy, you know, we got pirates. And it's much like I've mentioned about other events that E. Nelson Rodwell, although in this case, Barbara Zachas, of course, has featured in these stories, is like, the stuff is so old fashioned. Like the toys that are on sale here, of course, in 1980, a toy fair would have been Star Wars and like licensed stuff. But in this case, it's pirates and aliens and old knights and stuff that just really was not selling to kids anymore by this point. But you know, you can't have copyrighted characters.
There's some very careful copyright infringement avoidance going on, isn't there? Absolutely. Because in a later page, we see creatures and castles, not Dungeons and Dragons.
No.
And the mop heads are definitely not a ripoff of the Muppets later on. According to DC Wiki, take that as reliable as you want, although this says this was a February 81 comic, it said this was actually released on the 25th of December, 1980. Right. So, A, does anybody really publish comics on Christmas Day? Happy Christmas, 1980, Rob, by the way. And do you think that's why they brought the Toy Man in? Because it's quite unusual, isn't it, for this series to have actual DC comic villains used. Is that right?
It's rare. It's not complete. He isn't the only time they've ever done this, but it's pretty rare. Generally, the villains are one-offs or villains that are just super friends. Characters, but there's been a couple, Grax was a repeated character here and there, but generally they don't take on, you know, established villains of the of the heroes like Toyman's a longtime Superman villain. So it wouldn't shock me that they figured this was like the kind of the Christmas issue, and so let's have a toy theme for this one. Sure, why not?
And can we talk about Zan and Jane as Village of the Damned wigs? For sale? They do look a little. This is apparently a good disguise.
These blonde wigs that they're in.
And these blonde wigs.
John and Joanna Fleming.
Really creepy, And their buddy Lou looks the spitting image of Wally West. When I opened this, I thought, what's Wally West doing in this comic? Until his hair color changes halfway through.
Well, you know. They're just trying to get this done, Chris. I mean, you know.
Okay.
But just the Flemings, quote unquote, just happen to be at the toy fair. They see Toy Man bust in. They convert into, as I mentioned, the Thundercloud and an Exorian Shellback, who is basically kind of a giant alien turtle sort of thing. And they quickly make work of the Toy Man's henchmen, which are these guys. They're one guy's in the knight costume, another guy's in the pirate costume, and they subdue Toy Man. And we see in the bottom panel of page 6 that the Toy Man has a giant scar on his cheek. And there's a little blurb that says, "Reader, do you notice something different with the Toy Man's face?" And then in the next page is where we find out that the paper says, "Oh no, the Toy Man really did commit a robbery on another floor. That was a fake Toy Man." And the Super Friends are really mean. to the Wonder Twins. You know,
they are jerks to these kids. This is terrible mentoring.
They're like, how could you not know he doesn't have a scar on his face? Why would they know that? Why would?
Well, and if you're an inquiring child and you go, oh my goodness, did I miss this? Was my powers of observation so bad that I missed this? They only show the scar in that one final panel. And so it's completely obscured to the reader as well. It's not like it's obvious. Batman tears them off a strip. I mean, these, you know, this is not super friends. This is super dick boss. You know, this is awful. And then Janus says, well, you know, we made a bit of an error. They accept it. They're trying to learn from it. And Janus says, I hope Superman can come in and pick up Toyman's trail with his supervision. And then Wonder Woman, of all people, lays in and goes, hang on, you shouldn't rely on other people. You've got to trust your own power. Well, by that logic, Diana, what's the point of any superhero team at all? You know? Outrageous. Just terrible. This is not how you give feedback to junior colleagues. I'm so sorry, but this is just awful.
Is this what you do as head, clinic or whatever, whatever it is you work?
We go over how to give feedback to people. We say, well, you know, tell me how it went. What did you think? Tell me some things that went well. Let's start with that. And now I'm going to tell you some things that went well. And then you say, was there anything you could do better? And then you agree or disagree. And here they are, you know, what went well? Well, they did actually catch a whole bunch of villains.
Yeah, they did stop a crime. It wasn't the real plan, but they did stop a crime.
Let's see Batman turn himself into an Exorian shellback. you know, there were some mistakes made, but that's okay, because that's why they're in this team in the first place. So, you know, I thought this was really... really bad. Really, why be on this team? Just give up now. Just walk away.
The Super Friends comic was not known for its characterization. That was not what that's not what the book was about. It was about plot and some moral lesson that you could impart on children by the end of the book. But it's not about characterization. It never was. Just like the cartoon was. The cartoon, any line of dialogue could come out of any character's mouth. You know, that mean that Green Lantern talked like Batman, talked like Superman, talked like Aquaman. That's kind of the point of it. And here you finally, when the superheroes are actually kind of showing some personality, they're a bunch of jerks. And then you've got Robin saying, don't let these old timers get to you, kids, which I love that Robin is kind of like, don't trust any super friend over 30. Man, Robin. Yeah.
Well, and his advice is basically, I learned the hard way. Don't F up in front of Batman. You know, that's the best advice he can give.
Yeah, it's great. It's really, if I was the Wonder Twins, I'd be like, this sucks. Like, what is this about?
Aquaman's sort of slightly half-heartedly supportive, but it's not kind of leaping to their defense or anything.
Yeah, that's true. He does at least try. They assume they caught the toy man. They battled. Like, okay. You're like, all right. Like, oh, my God. So, it's an awkward sequence. So the next day, the toy man, there's this box of toys delivered, and it's a toy man action figure. And he talks about that. I'm going to commit a bunch of toy crimes, and the super friends, I dare you to stop me. And that calls the super friends in, and they all march in to this toy fair. By the way, this toy fair seems to be several days long, which is, I don't know, is this Woodstock? Like, what? Why is this toy fair like this long of a thing? But okay, fine. And they all march in. And the little toy man action figure talks to them. And then, of course, Robin is the deuces. Well, that could be the Jack in the Box group, which is playing. Now, I apologize. I assume this was E. Nelson Bridwell. It's not, as Chris just pointed out, Barbara Zachas. But I absolutely, if I had more time, and I do not, would love to have a list of fake rock bands from DC Comics, because they are the squarest sounding band. They are such bands that old guys think what rock and roll sounded like back when, you know, they're all still hippies or like, what, like, there's a band called Jack in the Bottle. What are you talking about? Like, okay, fine. And then, of course, they mentions the Mopeds filming their TV special in Gotham tomorrow. Fantastic. Absolutely great. So, Rod, you know, he says, okay, well, we're going to split up. And Batman says, you stay here And I love that Batman whispers, "Xan and Jane and me need some experienced help." Which is, and then Robin just says out loud, "Oh, nifty. You guys handle all the action while I play babysitter. Thanks a heap." So they're really dumping on the Wonder Twins in the
scene. Batman is just condescending on all levels to all the junior heroes, isn't it? "I'm whispering so Xan and Jaina don't hear how terrible I think they am. But you, Robin, get the duff job of babysitting them." He's just wiping the floor with them all at this point.
Great. So then we join the Jack in the Box concert in progress. They are listed as the most famous rock group in America today. And it is quite literally three guys dressed in clown suits.
So I've written in my notes, Kiss meets the Wiggles. They have terrifying Kiss style makeup, but they are then dressed in kind of ruffs and like got an actual box around their waist. If you do a gallery, I think you have to put this page up.
It is. And they are playing a stadium. Like you could see it. Yeah. They are this is like, this is, you know, this is like 80,000 people they're playing to. So,
and you would think this would be a kids group, but we see the fans and they are definitely not adults. They are definitely adults.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So and there's a great little riff where this spaceship comes floating in the crowd that you just mentioned says, "Look up in the sky. It's not a bird. It's not a plane. And it sure isn't Superman." Okay. That's a nice, you know, it's a fun little gag.
That's probably the best gag, actually.
Probably. And we see that two of the people standing guard are actually Superman and Aquaman. Why they needed to be in disguise, I don't really know.
I agree. That's exactly what I've written. You've got three guys dressed up on stage. Why did you bother to put on guard uniforms? Yeah.
Okay, you know, fine, whatever. So Superman and Aquaman stop the flying saucer from hoovering up the band's instruments, which, again, you know, the Toy Man's crime level is so minuscule. What is the resale value on some old mandolins and a drum kit? I mean, is that really worth the...
Not enough to reimburse you for a remote-controlled flying saucer, I'm going to say.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like, okay, all right, whatever. So Superman and Aquaman break into the space, the flying saucer, and they see that it was run by remote control. So there's no Toy Man there. Like, oh, okay, that's a problem. So now then we're at the Gotham TV studio where Batman and Wonder Woman are there. And they are talking to the mop heads and the puppeteers and the mop heads. And the one.
Definitely not Jim Henson.
No, definitely not Jim Henson. It's definitely kind of a bald. I do love the one mop head, the crocodile pulls a gun. That's just like a funny image of this crocodile suit.
Well, the bear is called Wuzzy Bear, which definitely isn't Fozzie Bear.
No.
And the crocodile is called Helmet the Lizard, which is definitely not Kermit the Frog.
No.
So let's just to be clear. But yeah, the crocodile, again, with a gun is great. And Wonder Woman uses her bracelets and she uses the phrase bullets and bracelets. And I thought, that's such a Wonder Woman phrase, isn't it? Bullets and bracelets. I wonder if that's the first time it's been used. And I looked it up and it's not. The first time it was used was the first issue, the first introduction of Wonder Woman, All-Star Comics number 8. In 1942. So that was a really historic phrase. And I thought, oh, wow. Okay.
They got it in on the ground floor there. That's pretty amazing. I do like the detail where they're talking to the not Jim Henson guy, where she says, "I wouldn't advise making such rash statements, Mr. Turner. Toy Man has murdered people before," which is it's like for a kid's comic. You're talking about murder. Like, okay. And so finally, a bunch of these puppets come alive. We see that there is a sort of dollar store Miss Piggy picking up one of the guys, and there is another guy in like a hood. I'm not really sure what that character means. It's kind of a slight Gonzo.
It doesn't. I was going to say a little Gonzo bit. Or Grover, maybe.
Something like that. And they cart them away. Batman tries to lasso them, and it doesn't work. And then they see that they open up the costumes, and they see that there's no people inside. They're all just robots. So once again, like, okay, this is not the Toy Man. This is not what's happening. Our super friends reconnoiter back at the Hall of Justice, and they realize, oh, this was all too easy to stop. This must have been a distraction from the real crime. And then said we go back to the Gotham Orphanage, where we see a bunch of crates are being delivered of toys from the Wayne Foundation.
Can we just say, Rob, it was a distraction from the real crime. just like the Wonder Twins were distracted from the real Toy Man. So they have fallen for the same ruse the second time around, and there's no insight or contrition. They fell for exactly the same thing that Batman gave them hell for. I'm just saying.
There's no one there to stand and say to the yeah. four of them, the four of you, hey, you guys are the experienced ones and you fell for this nonsense. If only the Justice Society were around to be older statesmen even further and say, what are you for, you idiots? So we see that the real crime is that the Toy Man is stealing toys from the Gotham orphanage. What an asshole. That's even like, I think even the Joker would be like, hey, now come on, Toy
it's
Man.
Christmas.
Like, that's, come yeah, on. What are we doing here? You're stealing toys from kids, orphans? What an SOB that Toy Man.
Like you say, he's very small-minded, isn't he?
I just mean-spirited, though. Yeah. I mean, aside from the penny-ante nature of the crime, that's just like, oh my God, come on. So the Toy Man's, all of his costumed helpers come out. Again, we've got the Native American and the cowboy and the space guy. Robin grabs a sled, which, okay, great. And because Zan has turned into a mound of snow and Jane has turned into a ram, they use the sled to come and knock out all these guys kind of one by one. They all take them out. And then, of course, in that moment, they realize, oh, the Toy Man has escaped. But Jaina, being very smart, turns into a hunting dog and sees that the Toy Man hasn't even escaped. He's just hiding in a box because he's just, again, such a little weasel. And they capture him. And that's it for the Toy Man.
That's it. It's great. I want to shout out how many changes Zan gets in this. Because it is, let's be honest, I'm so sorry, Zan fans, but changing into water-based things is a bit lame. But in this, he gets a thundercloud and a tidal wave and a mound of snow. And I think that's quite cool for, what is a short story. So I'm gonna give a bit of a big up to Zan for this one.
Okay, fair enough. So the Super Friends show up and they are all very proud of the Super Friends. And Batman again chides Robin for saying, yo, you sent us off on wild goose chases so you could arrest the Toy Man. And Robin's like, sending you? And the Wonder Twins are like, don't let him put you down, Robin. Sure, you can team up with us anytime. And so the younger members are all happy. And so all's forgiven, even though the Super Friends were a bunch of jerks in this issue. It's all good. All good.
And they all laugh.
And then, we cut to a commercial. If this was a cartoon, we cut to a commercial for some toys or whatever. So overall, what did you think? You said you read some other issues of Super Friends in kind of conjunction with the show, but what did you think of this story?
It's nuts. I mean, it really, it's crazy. It goes all over the place. And like I say, there's so much story packed into this. With the benefit of hindsight, I do kind of go, maybe they weren't great to the kids that they're supposed to be looking after. But, it's a fun story, isn't it? And there's loads of, we've had a lot of laughs talking about it. It's probably best that it's out of continuity, let's be honest. It's good fun. I think the Wonder Twins are great. I did go on and read the Mark Russell, what was it, Mark Russell recent one, which was really good. So, I think they're good characters. I think the first time I saw them actually was in Extreme Justice, which is probably a comic we want to talk very little about.
Yeah.
But they did show up in that. So they've sort of had a bit of a legacy, and I think that's good. I think Zan might have to have a bit of an up in his power set if he's going to do very much. But I enjoyed it. It was fun.
It said the Toy Man is just inherently to me one of the lesser of the villains of, part of it was his look. Part of it is, again, his MO is just so sort of pathetic. Yeah. Again, he's stealing from orphans and whatever and whatever, that kind of thing. I think there's a, I'm always happy when characters from the greater DCU are worked into the Super Friends. It kind of blends it all together. And the Toy Man is kind of a good low stakes villain for the Super Friends. Cause as a joke, you can't have the Joker. Really, you can't have anybody murdering anybody showing up in the, Ra's al Ghul is not going to show up to thwart the Super Friends. You can't have that.
Post-Watchmen Super Friends. Okay.
No. We don't need any of that. So, it's okay. Out of this story, who would you, I think I know what your answer is going to be. Who would you rate as the best friend? What hero do you think came off best?
Oh, yeah. So, bronze medal position, I think Aquaman for not being a complete jerk. Silver medal position is the robot that threw itself in front of the toy man and sacrificed its life. But the gold medal position is Robin, because Robin is the only friend that the Wonder Twins have through this whole thing. And he is the only one that supports them. So Robin is the is my friend. Null point for everybody else. And Batman and Robin, you get retraining on how to be a mentor.
Yeah, Robin places quite well in this story.
Yeah,
you know, yeah. And he takes some abuse at the end. I mean, he probably had a big laugh at the Super Friends because they're like, "Oh yeah, you guys were off at the Jack in the Box concert. Did you enjoy that? Yeah. You know, or whatever." Or talking to some puppeteers. Meanwhile, I'm capturing the toy man. So, that's the main story. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, that's it for Ramona Fraiden as our penciler. You know, one of the great. I think one of the great comic book artists of all time, still with us at like, I think she's like 95 years old. God bless her. Still does conventions, still does work occasionally. Once in a while, she'll do kind of like a variant cover for DC. Her run on Aquaman is one of my all time favorite runs on that character. Just one of the great comic book artists of all time. And the Super Friends benefited mightily from her.
Yeah.
Her work for 42, 41. I mean, there was a couple of Kurt Schaffenbergers here and there, but essentially she did 41 straight issues. And as I mentioned, she'll do the covers for the entire series. I do find it unfortunate that in the last year, a little plus that, she got saddled with Vince Coletta, as opposed to Bob Smith, who was to me her absolutely finest inker. But her work is so good that it even shines through even when Coletta does some different work. And so, you know, just really one of the great comic book artists in the Super Friends was one of the reasons I love the comic so much as a kid. And I love it today is because she was the main pencil.
I'm no artist. I'm a big fan of Hergé's work, you know, the Tintin stuff. And I think what I see in Ramona Fraiden's work is just that clarity of line, you know, with so little line work. She, you know, particularly on the faces. I mean, I haven't particularly liked the character of Wonder Woman, this, but the way she draws that face, it's so minimal, but you absolutely get all the expression. I think it's beautiful. Really good cartooning.
Yeah, it's wonderful, wonderful work. And like I said, I've met her at conventions and she's so sweet and so nice. And again, there's a book about her that you can get. I can't imagine in a field, even today where female comic book artists are still certainly in the minority. In the 50s, there had to be like three of them, you know, look, I mean, she had to be a minority within a minority. But man, if you ever have a chance to dig up some of the Aquaman work she did in Adventure Comics, it's just absolutely top notch stuff. And she had great runs on Metamorpho and Plastic Man. I mean, just really one of the great comic book artists to ever do it. And, she will be greatly missed, in this book. She'll keep doing the covers, as I said, but this is it for her as a regular penciler. So let's talk about the second story, which again, as I said at the top of the show, thank God it's not Jack-O-Lantern, because those have been pretty grueling. We get the Seraph again. Now, of course, just a couple issues ago, Captain Entropy and Henry Bernstein and I went on and on and on about how much we loved that Seraph story. I thought it was absolutely terrific. So I'm happy that he's back here now.
Yes.
Contrary to what I said earlier about, everything's written by E. Nelson Bridwell, this one isn't. This story is actually written and drawn by Bob Ochsner.
Yeah.
And inked by him as well. So this is really like almost like the Citizen Kane of Super Friends backups. Like it's all done by kind of one guy with just Jerry Serpe on colors and John Costanza on lettering. But man, I mean, so before we talk about the plot synopsis for the story, what are your feelings about the Seraph character, Chris?
Well, when we were talking about which book to go for and which issues you had left, I picked this issue because of this story. And, you know, I listened to that discussion with Henry and Catherine Entropy and, you know, I was, blown away by the discussion, the knowledge and the reverence. And Rob, I'm here to tell you, I bring none of that to this discussion because he is a really hot character. He's amazing. I think the art is so, could not be more different to the Super Friends story that we've already had, but it's really good. I love the art. I love the character. He's terrific. And we need the Seraph Absolute Edition before long, I think.
Totally. completely. Like I said, I was excited that he came back for this second backup feature. This one is called Dry Earth Stolen Waters. As I mentioned, it's just story and art by Bob Oxner. So a contingent of children from the United States are visiting a desalination plant located along the Red Sea under the supervision of Chaim Levon, a.k.a. the Seraph. But when they arrive at the camp, it seems deserted. Levon tries to ask those in charge, but he receives no answer other than a pre-taped message. Levon transforms into the Seraph and investigates. Inside, he sees that the plant has been taken over by industrial terrorists who are being paid to blow the place up to prevent the area from getting fresh water. The Seraph tries to stop them, but then one of the terrorists threatens to fire on the group of students they have kidnapped. Levon then calls upon the heavens to literally stop time, giving him the chance to throw the mantle of Elijah over the kids, deflecting the bullets. After defeating the rest of the terrorists, Levon takes the kids back home. They ask him how time could have stopped. Was it a miracle? Levon says, on the matter of miracles, everyone is entitled to their own opinion. So that is the backup for the Seraph, Dry Earth, Stolen Waters. What did you think of this, Chris?
I thought this was terrific. I think it's an 8-page story, so you really don't have a lot of real estate to tell much of a story, but it does a really good job. I think the stakes are genuine. You really feel for the students and the kids that are at threat. It's a really good introduction to all the powers of this quite obscure character. He does seem to spend quite a lot of the 8 pages getting most of his clothes off. By page 7, he's down to a Speedo and a Yamalka. So I don't know quite what that's about. But all of the powers, and there's a little bit of biblical stuff because he kind of does that. Well, we'll go into the plot, but he kind of channels Boy David beating Goliath, doesn't he, with his slingshot and all sorts of things. Some really interesting stuff. And it does have, in common with the previous story, the sort of biblical and other historical references spattered throughout to kind of inform it. So I think it's incredibly clever and a really good read.
Yeah. I, you know, again, contra to the main Super Friends stories, which are generally low stakes on purpose because they are kids' stories, this is, you know, these kids are going to get murdered. I mean, there's this panel where the bullets are literally flying at them. Now, we know they're not going to get killed because it's a Super Friends comic, but there's just generally more stakes in these Seraph stories than there are in the main book. Yeah. And I don't know whether this was intentional on first Ian B's part and then Bob Oxner's part. But I find we're two stories in to the Seraph, and he will get one more, by the way, he will get one more backup appearance in number, I'm not reading ahead, but he does appear in number 46, also written by Bob Oxner. So again, I'm not reading ahead, so I don't know what happens in that one. But I find it interesting that in the two appearances the Seraph has had as a solo character, both threats are not, they're not monsters. They're not aliens. They're not some, you know, some fanciful thing. They are just people who want to ruin the lives of the settlers. Yeah. And I find that just, I mean, whether that is a intentional kind of quasi political statement that either Ian B or Oxner is making, I just found it interesting that in a comic so fanciful with Super Friends, you've got aliens that can stop time. These are just real regular people that want to ruin the lives of these people trying to build a life for themselves out in this desert. I mean, it's all about the desalination plant. Is this corporation wants to stop them from having fresh water, you know? And I mean, I wonder if that's the kind of thing that if you're a little kid, you really notice that. But I noticed that. I was like, wow, these are all very, you know, these are like kind of ripped from the headlines kind of stories.
Loads to say there. So these definitely feel like more adult stories, even though there are more kids depicted in this story. And one thing I was going to say, I'm sure I've heard you say, it's actually quite difficult to draw children that don't just look like small adults.
It really is.
Kids, the kids on this look like children. They look like they are 7 to 10 years old, and they are at threat. And that feels high stakes. There is this real thread of faith all the way through. You know, so everything he does is, you know, has biblical reference and all the rest of it. And it's just a terrifically good story. And it does feel very different to what's come before. And I, you know, goodness knows, you know, the politics of the Middle East is no more resolved 40 years on than it was when this was drawn. So, you know, even just for that reason, it feels quite edgy in some ways. You know, shout out to the villain who's got the weirdest sunglasses and perm combination.
I love his look. Yeah.
You kind of just know he's going to be a villain from the very first appearance. But yeah, it feels like it's, you know, it's much edgier than the previous story. And you do kind of go, I'm glad it's here. I'm glad it exists. But I wonder if putting it in the back of Super Friends was the best place for it. I would love to see a full length story like this. I think it would be terrific.
Yeah. And Ochsner, you know, you mentioned like, you know, Seraph at one point is basically just running around in his shorts and his yarmulke, and that's it. I mean, they're definitely leaning into like, you know, this is like the beefcake of this. Like, look at this guy. He's running, he looks like Arnold Schwarzenegger kind of thing with his build. But I love that in that, the last page, you know, as you mentioned, it's only 8 pages. They got to move fast. They don't have a lot of time, but I love that one panel where after he's defeated the bad guys and the one guy says, oh, the Seraph has saved the demolition plant. Oh, no need. Look. And then he's standing there and he's got his staff and he says, they came to destroy, but remain to face judgment. And like, that is that's like a cover pose. Yeah. You know, I mean, that is like, that would be his, if he had gotten a Who's Who listing, that would have been his pose. Cause it's an iconic shot. I mean, I've been saying this every time he shows up. This is a character that they could have done so much more with, and they really have not.
Agree. Yeah. So, Seraph, if you need to be sold on Seraph, come for the beefcake, stay for the religious authenticity. You know,
absolutely.
That's the catch line. But yeah, I think what this does is he uses all these various bits of his costume. So he's got the ring, which gives him understanding, and he kind of recognizes that there's a parallel with destroying the guard tower to the story of David and Goliath. And he stretches this steel cable between trees to kind of use it as a slingshot. And then he's got this staff, which seems to be able to grow in size. So he uses it as a pole vault.
Yeah.
And then when he's beating the bad guys with it, it looks for all the world like an ice hockey stick that he's beating them around with. And the kids are into that. You know, the kids are really up for him giving them a
sock
him
out away, Seraph.
He uses his cape to protect them. And there's a slightly unfortunate panel where you look like he's thrown his cloak over them and the machine gun bullets are hitting the cloak. And it does look like there's an awful lot of blood spattering off them. But really, it's the bullets ricocheting. You're okay. It's all right. Yeah. But the big thing is the stopping of time, isn't it? And for that, he calls on, and they don't say the word God. They say a mightier source.
Holy one.
And they use the word holy one. So I don't know if that was a deliberate, you know, if that was a kind of, this is going to upset some group. I'm sure in the modern day, this would upset somebody. But, you know, they steer clear of sort of being really explicit about it being God, but it's not, you know, you don't have to make that much of a leap. And time stops in order for him to defuse the bomb and save the kids. In that order, by the way.
We see the bullets like an inch away from the kid's face as he's pulling the bomb.
Very close to that kid's ear. But there's so much in this character. You know, he's kind of got his, you know, he's kind of Green Lantern power ring type religious artifacts that can do amazing and miraculous things. But when push comes to shove, he can't do it by himself. And he calls on God to change fundamentally what's going on. I think that's an incredible step for a comic book to take. You know, I mean, we have the Spectre, don't we? But it's an immensely powerful story. And I can see why Henry was so excited to have, you know, a Jewish hero who is, you know, incredibly strong in his faith, doing all these amazing things.
Yeah, it's terrific. It's really terrific. And it also strikes such an amazing contrast with the backups we've gotten to this point, because it's either Wonder Twins, which, you know, I'm kind of, you know, eye rolly a little, like, all right, okay, they're going to face another completely useless kind of thing. And then you've got Jack-O-Lantern, which I don't mean to keep beating up on, but it's like, that's a character whose potential is completely thwarted through the stories that he's been given so far. But Seraph, they're two for two. They're batting 1,000 on these Seraph stories. So
I would eat up a Seraph miniseries. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I ask you about the last bit where the kids sort of question him about all the amazing things he's done?
Mm-hmm.
And they say, one of the girls asks, how could time stop without throwing the Earth off its orbit? And I read that and thought, there's a Superman the movie reference if ever I heard it.
Ian B. probably saw that and he was like, hey, wait a minute. I don't, you know. All right. Yeah, that's true. That's a smart kid, you know, that she thinks of it like that. She's like, hey, but I want to second your comment about Bob Oxner. It is very hard to draw children that don't just look like Mickey Rooney. You know, they just look like just small adults. These look like kids. They look like children. Oxner, again, just bringing it. It's a terrific story. It's just really terrific. These are just the highlights of these comics, these Seraph stories. So, I like that he's like, well, what do you think too, by the way? I like that he's like, oh, kids, you think of it for yourselves. It's just absolutely great.
It's a good politician's answer.
True. Absolutely. Yeah. So,
you ask a really good question. And I won't answer it. I'll leave it up to you, but that's good. That's great. It's
freedom.
It's really
freedom. Yeah. Like freedom. We know we all like freedom. Yeah. So anyway, that's the Seraph. Just a terrific story. So I liked the Super Friends story. It's okay. But by the law of that, you know, the Seraph story brings all the rising tide, you know, brings, you know, boys all boats. The fact that the Seraph story again is so good, it brings the whole issue up like a full letter grade. If we were going to be doing you know,
it is the what your entry fee buys you. That's the reason to look into this 40 whatever it is your old comic. Go and look at the stuff. It's terrific.
Yeah, really good stuff. So, well, Chris, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this issue. Super, I can't believe we've never talked comics before, but now we're going to have to do that again on Mountain Comics or something. So, thank you so much for being here.
That is a pleasure, Rob. We've talked comics on other places, but you know, not broadcast.
That's true. We talk about them in other respects. So, I will, say to everybody, I want you to stay tuned. Well, first of all, let me say, Chris, why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet if they want to?
You always do. It's kind of on here. Shag and I are doing a thing soon, and you and I might do a couple of things soon. I don't know.
You'll be back on Film and Water. Absolutely. I can guarantee that.
Yeah. We're doing a couple of mashes.
You do, right? There's some mash coming. That's right. We have that to look forward to. So are you doing something with Shag as well?
Yep.
Okay. Well, all right.
He tends to be more secretive, I've noticed. He doesn't like people to say. So I can't say. But okay. Yeah, I am.
There's some legal issues he has with Florida. So, anyway, we'll have that to look forward to here on the network, future appearances by Chris. So, I want everybody to stay tuned. I'm going to run a podcast promo, but when I come back, Chris Franklin, this show is full of Chris's, will be joining me once again for a For All Merch Kind segment focusing on the great Ramona Fraiden. So stay tuned, everybody.
In all his decades of publishing history, one event has affected Superman more than any other. Worlds lived, worlds died, and that was only the beginning. Superman was never the same. Presenting Superman in Crisis. Available weekly from January 3rd, 2022 at johnreadscomics.com.
And we're back. And as promised, it's another installment of For All Merch Kind. And that means Chris Franklin is back. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Rob. How's it going?
It's going great. Thank you for coming back. I don't want to say I apologize because I don't think I have anything to apologize for, but I do feel a little bad that I did two merch segments with other people. I know we did one with Andrew, one with Max, but those were character specific. But you pitched this to me a while back because we knew this final Ramona Fraiden issue of Super Friends was coming, and you pitched something really remarkable. And so why don't you just tell everybody what it is? Cause I had never even heard of this thing/things that we're going to talk about.
Okay, so about a year ago, it was back in the fall. I was in Bowling Green, Kentucky, in an antique store, and I saw a Superman item inside a case, and I'm like, is that Ramona Fraiden art on the front of that? And so I asked the guy to get it out of the case, and it was a slip case of four books. And the four books, the set is called The Story of Superman. And there's four books inside. And yes, the artwork in each book and on the outside in the slip case is by Ramona Fraiden with inks by Dave Hunt. And it is wonderful. It is a beautiful set of books.
I can't think of another piece of merchandise that we've ever chronicled here on the show or that I've ever seen that has art by Ramona Fraiden. I can't think of another example. Can you?
No, I can't either. That's why I was so stunned that it was her. But I mean, as soon as I turned over the spine where Superman's coming out of a phone booth, that was very Ramona. The one on the front, I was kind of on, but that image is—it's that kind of bulky, you know, that thick-bodied Superman that she drew, and I'm like, that is her. And then I, you know, the guy let me look inside, and I'm like, it says it's she gets credited, art by Ramona Fraiden and Dave Hunt. And me and Cindy are both fans of Ramona Fraiden. You know, I got Cindy her biography her birthday or Christmas just recently. And we've got three sketches by Ramona on our wall that she drew. So we plunked down $20 quick for this set of books.
It is remarkable because I have by the way, there will be pictures. Chris was nice enough to take pictures of this set. And so these pictures will be up on the gallery page over on the website, fryandwaterpodcast.com, of course. But I have never, like, okay, you and I are old enough to you know, obviously to have straddled different eras of merchandising where now, like, merchandising delves really deep into, like, the catalog of the characters and the origins. Like, every, like, most kids know the origins of, like, Spider-Man now or the Hulk, right? But or even, like, the sub characters thanks to all the movies. But generally the merchandise pre probably the 90s did not get too deep into the worlds of these characters, and these four books in this slipcase that you mentioned, like, is incredibly detailed about the history of Superman. It's really pretty startling. I've never seen anything like it where they get this deep into, like, the mythos of Superman.
Oh yeah. And there's no credit for a writer, but I would be stunned if E. Nelson Bridwell didn't at least hand whoever wrote this a stack of notes, because it's just it's too detailed. I mean, if anybody's ever read Action Comics number 500, which is the life story of Superman, that was supposed to be a treasury.
Don't remind me.
I know. Yeah. This is essentially that minus the framing sequence where Superman's at the museum and Lex has cloned him and all that stuff. I mean, each book, there's a book about how Superman, there's the four books are how Superman came to Earth, The Adventures of Super Baby, When Superman Was Superboy, and then Superman in Metropolis. So these four books chronicle Krypton, his two periods in Smallville, and then when he comes to Metropolis as Superman. And I mean, they follow the Silver Age story of Superman to the letter. I mean, right down to every story detail, even to how they discovered that his blankets were impervious to, you know, everything. And I mean, where he got the lenses for his glasses so the heat vision wouldn't melt them, you know, out of the canopy of his rocket. I mean, it is just dead on. I mean, and the artwork is just flat gorgeous in these books. I mean, and for instance, like on page two of the How Superman Came to Earth, the Krypton book, there's a very sapphire stag like Kryptonian female on that page, which I love.
I love you've got the classic Silver Age or Gold. Yeah, Silver Age Jor-El. In the scenes, you know, he's got the sun on his chest. Like, he looks like a superhero. That whole thing with the headband, and you've got the, you know, the Kryptonian elders, you know, tutting him about and stuff like that. I mean, can you think, again, you think of, like, another piece of merchandise that features Jor-El on it? You know, like, where else would you even see that?
No, I mean, there's some stuff that was tied into the movie, you know, but very rarely. Yeah. And I mean, this has to be the merchandise that has, I mean, I don't even know if there's been anything since that has this much Ma and Pa Kent in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are in it like, you know, they're in, of course, the two books in the middle that were Super Baby and Super Boy. They're prominent in those books. And, you know, I love the way Ramona draws them. She draws them when they find baby Kal-El a little bit younger than we sometimes saw them. Of course, they did that crazy thing where they de-aged them in the late Silver Age, and then they, you know, they drank some kind of rejuvenation formula or some crazy stuff like that. I don't know. They tried to explain it. But there's so much Ma and Pa Kent. They show Superboy's secret, tunnel that he, you know, to get in and out of the
right,
house.
Yeah.
which I always thought was one of the coolest things in the old, you know, New Adventures of Superboy comic that I read growing up. You're right. I mean, there's very few things I've ever seen even since. I mean, yeah, like you said, since everybody knows who freaking, you know, Okoye is nowadays, you know, which she's great. I mean, not saying nothing against Okoye, but like mm-hmm. people on the street know who Okoye is, including on top of Black Panther, you know, they know yep. who she is. There's so much detail in these books. It's amazing how, you know, the fact that they get into how Superboy discovered that, he, you know, kryptonite could hurt him, and that, you know, there was this, I love the leaps of comic logic that are still in here. He found out that, you know, that lead would protect him when a Superboy robot stood in between him and the Rock. And, you know.
No, again, we'll see some of the pictures of these on the website, but why don't you explain to them how big these books are? Because they're kind of like sort of oblong digest size sort of thing, right?
Yeah, they're kind of the size of, like, I would say, like almost like a postcard, like a small postcard or something like that, or maybe like an index card. I guess an index card. They're about that size. I didn't measure them, but I think they're, you know, roughly like 3x5. And, you know, they, a lot of times, you know, you open them up and the images go across the spread. But I mean, they're a storybook type. They're not comic, you know, panels per se. There's a few word balloons here and there. But I mean, Ramona does a wonderful job with the format. I mean, the shot of baby Kal-El's rocket taking off. I love the forced perspective mm-hmm. On that page in the first book, How Superman Came to Earth. I mean, that's one of the more dynamic shots I've seen of the rocket leaving Krypton. You know, that's a great shot. The shot at the end of the book with Martha holding Kal-El. I mean, it's just a really sweet, you know, idyllic, you know, Andrew Wyeth kind of like Superman the movie kind of feel to it. You know, it's got that same kind of middle America type feel to it, which, you know, of course, what you want from the Kents. And one thing I really thought was funny is, they find out how Super Baby is, you know, indestructible in this, and he gets a bull, like he's pulling up a stump, and a bull like basically rams him, rams his behind, you know, with his head, his horns, and then the bull's like shown like, you know, Looney Tunes style with stars going around his head. Later, he knocked him cold, which it made me think, like, did John Byrne read this, because he had. He had that bit where the bull ran over Clark and it didn't hurt him, right?
That's right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
In Man of Steel. So yeah, there is a part in the Super Baby book though that probably wouldn't fly nowadays, because Super Baby first uses his heat vision to light Pa Kent's pipe. So in a children's book, you know, but and also Pa Kent tries to spank Super Baby for tearing up the shed because he came through, you know. But it's they're so charming, you know, and Ramona's art is perfect. And I love the way she draws. The kids look like kids. We've talked about that on this network before. And we brought up John Byrne before. John Byrne's great. Can't draw kids. They don't look like children. These kids look like little kids. In fact, Superboy looks really young, but I think he was supposed to be 8. So. It makes sense, you know. He looks more like the Superboy that first showed up in like More Fun Comics, like when Joe Shuster was still drawing him.
Yeah, yeah, he was like a little kid. He was not a teenager,
right?
In those adventures, yeah,
yeah, yeah. They're so great. I mean, of course, you know, when you get to the Superman era and Superman in Metropolis, you know, there's, you know, she does a great job drawing Lois and the Superman cast. We didn't really see that in the Super Friends comic. You know, her Clark Kent looks great, and her Lois is really fetching in her little. I mean, she's like got a, you know, it's almost like she looks kind of like a female version of Action Jackson. She's got the white belt and the collared it's a dress, but it kind of looks like a jumpsuit almost.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, and she's got the, you know, you get to see her draw the fortress and the, you know, the big dinosaur inside and the giant key and Jimmy's signal watch and her Lex Luthor, the page where Lex is swooping into the foreground. Superman's in the back, but he's blasting his ray gun with his heat vision. That's a nice image. I mean, a lot of these images you could just see being used on like a lunchbox or.
Totally.
Or
totally.
some other piece of Superman merchandise, Slurpee cup or, you know, something like that.
If only DC had bothered to do nicer artwork on the Slurpee cups.
Right. I mean, it doesn't sugarcoat things like in the Superboy book. It says, you know, after we've seen Ma and Pa Kent for two of these books, it says Clark graduates from high school. His Ma and Pa have died and Superboy leaves Smallville. Oof. I mean, I imagine being the parent reading that to a kid, like, what happened to Ma and Pa Kent? You know, and we get Lex losing his hair, you know, mm-hmm. and the way Ramona draws him before Superboy puts out the experiment in his lab and it makes his hair fall out. But the way the face she gives Lex, he's so angry. I can imagine him like, you know, plotting revenge, you know, of a lifetime against Superman just based on this page, even over hair loss. You know, so, which I know it wasn't just hair loss. I know Michael Bailey, it wasn't just that, but, you know, everybody always says that, but yeah, I love these books. To me, they're the Silver Age Superman, you know, they're the Silver Bronze Age Superman in a nice little package and it's beautifully drawn. And Dave Hunt, you know, he was inking Kurt Swan a lot.
Right. He's a longtime Superman inker. Right.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, it you know, and you can kind of see his influence, especially on, like, Clark Kent faces here and there. And he's actually a really good inker for her, too. I would have liked to have seen him maybe do it instead of Vince Coletta on Super Friends, but, you know, that's...
Well, yeah. Fill in name of inker instead of Vince Coletta, but okay. I can't quite see in the... Because the text is still small to say. Does it say what year these came out? I mean, it had to have been around the movie.
Yeah, 1980, I believe. Let me double check.
1980. All right, so yeah. But like the same time as these issues of Super Friends that we're doing. So, okay, so it's actually... A little past the movie. I mean, it's in the middle of Superman 1 and 2, right. But it's not, it's funny. I would have imagined like 78 would have been the time to put it out, the huge marketing push of the first movie. But I guess anything in between those movies, you know, those years is ripe for Superman merchandise because of the movies. Yeah, it's a really nice set. And considering how family friendly, for lack of a better term, Ramona Freyden's work was, I'm surprised she didn't get tapped more often to do merchandise. Her stuff is really kind of merchandising friendly. So mm-hmm. It's shocking to me that this is, as far as we know, the only thing she ever did. But, you know, we've chronicled other stuff and you have found lots of things for me that I've never seen. And there's still more stuff that we're going to get to. You know, like you'll show me like a Super Friends puzzle game, right? And I'm like, well, I've never seen that before, but it's a variation on some other thing that we've seen.
Right.
So it's not shocking. They're like, oh, okay. There's a Parcheesi puzzle, versus it. But this, you know, I have never heard of these at all. And when you sent me the pictures, I was like, I never knew these existed. I'd never read an article about them. I've never heard them mentioned by anybody. Like, I don't know that maybe they were not successful, but it's a really handsome set. And the slipcase is a nice touch, by the way, like putting them in this little box. It's really, really nifty.
I kind of wonder, this was from Random House, and I wonder if they weren't available through, like, you know, the book fairs or something at school.
Scholastic,
you know? Yeah, Scholastic Book Fair or something like that. Yeah, I can see these being available, you know, through the weekly reader thing you used to get at school, you know, and stuff like that. So I could, the catalogs they would give you, I can see those coming from there. You know, I have a Superman pop-up book from around this era that's drawn by Kurt Swan, a really beautiful book. And I have a few years later, I have a Superman storybook that's drawn by Kurt Schaffenberger. So they were tapping like the Superman artists to do these things at the time, which I think is great. I mean, I love that. that they did it. And my understanding is that a lot of times these comic book artists made a whole lot more money.
Oh, sure.
When they drew these, and the better than their page rate, obviously.
Yeah. I'm sure Ramona made a pretty penny on these, all these illustrations she had to do. And it was for, yeah, I would imagine you would want to do more stuff like this. Cause that, I mean, there's a reason why Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name, you know, was so big on doing the merchandise. He probably made more money from that than he did slaving out a whole page, you know? Yeah. So yeah. I was just going to say that, like, you know, we know that you love it. I love it. There's that Batman collected book by Chip Kidd.
Yes.
Which is all the Batman merchandise, not all of it, but it, you know, obviously selected pieces from his collection. And that's a gorgeous book. And there's even one for Captain Marvel, which is again by Chip Kidd, because he's a big Captain Marvel fan. Mm-hmm. There needs to be a Superman one of this. There really does. I mean, I know that you would have to really pick and choose, because Superman has been merchandised since like 6 months after he debuted.
Yeah.
So you're talking 85 years of merchandise that you could perm through, but there needs to be some, you know, nice hardcover book of the range of his merchandise, because the guy, you know, Batman was merchandisable past 1966. Superman had a good 25 years on him to you know, have this kind of stuff.
I'm really surprised. As far as I know, there hasn't been a big lavish, you know, coffee table book like that. You know, I know at one time, like, the premier Superman collector was Danny Fuchs, but I haven't even heard anything about him for years. So I don't know if he's still with us. I don't know that. Obviously there's a museum in Metropolis, Illinois. I think the guy named Jim Hambrick that owns that, he could write a book. You know, a lot of these guys, you know, there's some guys out there that could do it. But I would love to see them do it. And I would love to see somebody, you know, they should reprint this in like one volume, you know, like the four books, or, you know, just reprint this. I mean, I think this would go over well now. You know, I mean, that's one thing that DC's good about. You know, you walk into a comic book shop, or there's all these young readers, you know, books for about the DC characters that, you know, go from, you know, like the preschool age up through.
Yeah, the board books, you know, all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. The young adult reader books that they do nowadays. And, you know, I would love to see this get reprinted. I think it stands up. And, you know, it would be nice to see this, you know, if nothing else, if, you know, some kind of Super Friends omnibus, put this in in the back, you know, you know, or something like that. That would be great. Yeah.
Totally. Totally. Said. So I thank you so much for finding this and for thinking of me to do it on the show. Cause it really lined up perfectly that this is what we're going to be talking about for Ramona's last issue on the book. As I've said in the opening segment with Dr. Chris Lewis, Ramona would continue to draw the covers through the end of the series. So this isn't, she's not totally off the book, but this is her last appearance as the, you know, inside artist. So it really was perfect to finally do a piece of merchandise with her artwork on it. And before we sign off here, again, Chris, like, this is not going to be your last appearance on For All Mankind before we wrap up, but I do want to give you the chance to, like, why don't you wax Ramona's car a little bit, since this is her last issue as a regular prince. I know you've already talked about, you got sketches from her. But I mean, yeah, she really is, like, just as I said again, the previous segment, she's one of the greats.
Oh yeah, I mean, her style, her artwork style, she's got a unique style. But at the same time, every character she drew in the Super Friends book, you know, it felt like they felt right. You know, she had a knack for, like, okay, well, I'll draw this character this way, and they're dead on. They look correct, but just the simplicity of line, just the way she could have, you talked about that picture, that image of Jor-El in this book with the Kryptonian Council. I mean, Jor-El's head's hanging down. I mean, yeah, she's got to kind of, this is a children's book, she's got to kind of, you know, make the characters act a little more broadly, but man, she sells it. I mean, you get that Jor-El is just so defeated. And these Kryptonian guys are a bunch of stuffy, you know, they're like in Superman the movie, you know, a bunch of stuffy old farts, and they're about to get it, you know, but I mean, come on, you know, everybody else is going to get it too, unfortunately. But, she just puts that across so well. Her artwork is so deceptively simple. But it's just beautiful. I mean, just what she can put across in just the thickness and thinness of her line, and the number of lines she puts into a face. She's just one of the masters. And I think she's incredibly underrated. I know there's a lot of people that love her. I still think she's incredibly underrated. I think the fact that she was the one of the few female artists working in the late golden age up through the Bronze Age. I think that's something that, you know, she deserves more attention for that alone, on top of the fact of just being a phenomenal artist, no matter man or woman. You know, she's mm-hmm. just one of the best. And so I'm so glad that this show was able to shine a spotlight on her, because she more than deserves it.
Totally. And as I said again in the previous segment, still, you know, still out there, still, yeah. still doing cons and still doing. I was at a comic shop a couple of weeks ago, and like there was a variant cover that she did, you know, yeah. I'm like, with Metamorpho. I'm like, God, she's like 95 years old, still doing variant covers. Like, right. you know, amazing. Absolutely amazing. So yeah, this is a fun set. I'm not a, you know, I don't collect too many things anymore because I'm just, you know, there's only so much space that I have. But man, if I saw this set in a antique store, it would definitely turn my head. I'd be like, how much? You know, because it's yeah. just really nifty. It's really, really nifty. So thank you so much for taking the time to take pictures of all the pages and sending it in for everybody to check out.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Any you know, to help. I love talking about this stuff with you. And I just want people to see this because it's just beautiful. And I think a lot of Superman fans are Superman fans, and our Ramona fans will be really happy to see it.
Absolutely. So, well, once again, thank you so much, Chris, for coming by and doing For All Merch Kind. We will be doing some more Merch Kind segments in the upcoming episodes. But stay tuned. Once again, I'm going to run a commercial announcement. And when I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
Supernatural. Now you can join the battle between brave Lionheart and the evil Skull and their eerie ghostlings.
Lion, you're done. Now, Master.
They change to fight with ghostly might. Turn them into the light, and they change into even more powerful creatures.
Now, the winding is free. Take this.
Supernaturals. Lionheart, Skull, and Ghostling sold separately. New from Tonka.
And it's time for listener feedback, and these are the comments we got on the previous episode of For All Mankind, episode 40, with my super friend Russell Burbage. First up is Brian Chufo, who says, another fun episode. Really enjoy hearing from letter writers from years past. Recently, the Batman Family Reunion podcast also had a letter writer appear. Hopefully, there will be more. I'll have to dig out my copy of The New Adventures of Superboy, where I had my only letter printed, though my name was misspelled, and see if there are any podcasts covering it. Rob, Brian, I mean, there are a bunch of great Superman-centric podcasts. Michael Bailey does one, and Bob Fisher, and there's a bunch of other great ones. I don't know if any of them have focused on that particular series, but you'll have to check it out. I remember that comic. I kind of enjoyed it. If there is no podcast devoted to it, there should be. Sean M. Myers from This Very Network says, welcome back, Russell. Glad to hear from you again. I have two more reasons why your in-stock trade recommendation, the Legion of Superheroes Treasury hardcover, is perfectly valid. In the print copy of Super Friends number 40, there is a special center spread ad page printed on the same paper stock as the cover. The center image is a two-page ad for the Atari 2600, but on the backside of that are two ads and a PSA. The PSA is a shot of what I believe is a Schaffenberger Superman holding a letter for vaccinations against polio, measles, and rubella. The first ad is a full-page ad for Dial H for Hero, letting us know that the free preview insert will be in issue 272 of the Legion of Superheroes, with their Adventure Comics debut occurring the month after that. And the ad sharing the page with PSA is for the Secrets of the Legion of Superheroes 3-issue miniseries. Good Lord, Sean, that was a lot of detective work for kind of a minor point, but I appreciate it nonetheless. You know, I think I've mentioned this on some podcast, maybe an episode of Fire and Water or something, but I really would love to do like a special miniseries just on those DC free preview books that they did. I love those things. Those were so fun. And I remember even going out of my way to collect issues that had them, even if it was a series I didn't normally buy, because I just thought they were so fun. And that would be kind of fun to cover sometime, but I have to put that in the to-do file. Rob McCarthy says, I don't know that San Francisco of the late 80s and early 90s had whole clubs devoted to underage shows, but they were surely underage nights, usually Wednesday. I guess was, they would not lose much money. I was always either buying either single ticket or the band's guest list, or sometimes just let in because nobody wanted to watch a kid in a wheelchair fumble with his wallet. People can be very kind given a chance. I have no idea how the clubs made money, still less how the bands made money. Yeah, I mean, there's going to be a couple letters talking about these underage clubs. This is just completely alien to me. Mike Thomas says, great discussion as always. I enjoy this podcast every month. Russell's letter to the editor was awesome. I'm pretty sure I had this issue back in the day. The cover is very familiar to me, as are most of the covers as I bought this comic pretty regularly. I always appreciate the gallery images you post. Thank you, Mike. They are a giant pain. So I'm glad somebody gets used to them. The panel of Superman flying into the side of the ship gave me Superman 3 vibes of when evil Superman flies into the side of the oil tanker. Speaking of which, I wonder if maybe a Gus Gorman backup feature would have been better than the Jack-O-Lantern backup in this issue. Well, Superman 3 came out in 1983, so I guess Gus Gorman didn't even exist at this time. Yeah, you're a little early for that. But yeah, given these Jack-O-Lantern backups, I probably would have liked anything instead of those. Ito Buznar says, oh man, Russell is like geek royalty. That's just because of the letter, and a very critical one, no less, published in this issue of Super Friends, but also of all the other letters he had published. That's pretty amazing. Like Rob, I wrote a few letters and none of them ever got published. Otherwise, yeah, it's a bit sad that we're nearing the end of the series and hence this podcast, and also that Frayden's tenure on it is almost over. And speaking of the art, I have to say that, based on the pages posted in the image gallery, Kim DeMolder was a really good inker for Frayden, certainly much better than Coletta. I'm thinking that in an ideal world, he would have been brought on earlier and Frayden would have stuck around. And since it came up in the show and also in the comments here, there was an under 21 dance club in the nearest big, well, biggish city, Salem, Oregon, when I was a teen. I think the lower age cutoff was 16. I went there with a few times a group of friends when I was in high school. One thing I specifically recall that didn't faze me back then, but I really realized was pretty skeevy, was that there were a lot of guys in their late 20s, early 30s among the guests. Bucky749 says, another great episode. The guest was great. The villain was interesting, not one I've heard of. Also, my brother and I collect comics. My bro focuses on Harvey Comics, especially your old pal, Richie Rich. You know, like the free previews, I really feel like there should be a Richie Rich podcast. I mean, as Sean and Paul Ken are always noting over on Batman Family Reunion, Richie Rich had like minimum 6 comics a month. I mean, he smoked Superman or Spider-Man. So, you know, respect must be shown. So I don't know. You know, those stories are all kind of the same. I don't know like how that would work on a podcast, but I think Richie Rich deserves a podcast. There, I've said it. Cellar Dweller says, hello, Rob, Russell, and all the other super fans. Thank you for another great episode. And now onto the issue. Like Rob, I like the cover and it'll be the last one to feature the entire cast, unless you count a future issue that features the floating Wonder Twin heads. Best friend goes to Batman, in my opinion, as he was the one who came up with the plan to stop the Monocle. As for the Monocle, you could tell the story was in the 70s as the Madman, instead of going on a spree of violence, decides to mess with people's senses. At least he ended up in a hospital where he can get help, LOL. 3 observations about the Wonder Twins. Once again, we see them in training with a senior hero, which I enjoy. Second, in this issue, we see a trope that got used in the cartoon frequently, where Xana and Jaina are separated and unable to activate their powers. Last, the Monocle created the cages to trap them because, as Batman stated, he thought he couldn't manipulate their Exorian senses. I'm assuming because they are aliens. Wouldn't that be then also the same for Superman? If Superman's senses were affected, one could assume that the same result would happen for the Wonder Twins. Oh, and you had mentioned that you want the podcast to stop at a nice even number of 50. I wish that DC had done that with this comic series. Issue number 48 could have been the conclusion of the Overlord Futurio storyline, resolving in the arrest of Overlord. Issues 49 and 50 would have been 2 oversized books, starring the JLA and the Global Guardians. The end result would be Xana Jada graduating to hero status like Wendy and Marvin did. Yeah, you know, Cellar Dweller, I like how you think. I don't know. Maybe it was just my sense of, you know, nerdy completion. But yeah, I never liked it when any comic series got canceled just a few issues short of like an anniversary. I remember DC Comics Presents last issue was number 97. And I was like, you couldn't let it go to number 100 for Pete's sakes. I don't know why that bothered me, but it does. But anyway, those are all fantastic suggestions. I love that. Yes, I think that Super Friends should have gone to number 50 and they should have let E and B end it with like some sort of giant double size thing. That would have been just awesome. Captain Entropy says, I think it's pointy ears to disrupt the whole census discerning process, Cellar Dweller. The Monocle tested it on Vulcans, the Submariner, and Santa's elves and got nothing. It was great to hear Russell and especially to hear his letter and his thoughts on it decades later. I enjoyed this episode, but have no further comments, Your Honor. Looking forward to more Overlord and more Seraph. One of those two things makes sense, Captain. Chris Franklin, of course, from this network and this very episode, says, great to hear whatever happened to Russell Burmage, teenage art critic. Also nice to hear Ramona was a good sport about it years later, even if she did throw shade at E&B. I had this issue, but not the next, so I had to sneak a peek on the DC Universe Infinite app, and I can confirm we have Ramona for one more issue and episode, this one. When I first read the JLA-JSA-SSOSV crossover, I recalled this issue when coming across the monocle. I didn't really worry about their different visuals, because I surmised that this SF monocle was from Earth 1. See, Marv? I was like six until they got the multiple Earths. I assumed Earth 1 monocle had more appearances than this, but apparently not. It's weird how some innocuous comic images live rent-free in your brain. The shot of Robin on the hood of that car remains with me to this day. I'm with you on Jack-O-Lantern. I always thought his look was cool, but I wish he had more Halloween-y in his design and color scheme. Those stories, no thanks. Go sign to that, Chris. Dr. Ange has another fun episode. Always good to hear Russell. And nice projector connective tissue to start things out. Just a couple of comments. The first image of the monocle looks a wee bit like Peter Cushing to me. I wonder if Ramona used him as a model. This is the second Jack-O-Lantern story we were reminded of his phenomenal cosmic power, only to have him do basically nothing. Come on! Lastly, under 21 clubs did exist in Rhode Island, but I never went to them. Why would I pay $20 to be rejected when I was doing quite well being rejected for free? There's so much to unpack in that sentence, Dr. Edge. Isamu Yukinori says, about the monocle's appearance in Flash Comics number 64, he did appear pretty much as George Perez drew him in JLA 195 through 197, except he would remove his monocle from his eye and hold it like a magnifying glass to fire his ray beams instead of firing beams while the monocle is placed on his face. However, the first symbolic panel of the story did show him firing a beam from his monocle while wearing it. This may be inspired Mr. Perez to draw the monocle using his weapon this way. And the Flash comic story is very Super Friends in terms of tone. Jonathan Cheval invents a monocle and converts cosmic rays into a ray beam that can destroy lead or a person or a building. Then he thinks to himself, sometimes it frightens me to possess such gigantic powers. It's a fortunate thing that I am by nature an honest citizen. Otherwise, I might be tempted. Unfortunately, three crooked businessmen decide to swindle Cheval out of his optical shop property, which was also his home. So Cheval becomes tempted to use his monocle for revenge. Isamu was nice to actually post the splash page of the story. It looked pretty cool. I actually kind of want to read it now. Brett Young says, great show, Rob and Russell. Crazy issue. Right off the bat, my favorite moment is Superman doing the dirty dancing time of my life bit with the whale. Supes and Aquaman sure were catty mocking the sea captain's monocle. Ha ha, nice look, Monopoly guy. Oh my God, there's at least three passengers wearing white pants after Labor Day. Must be a carnival cruise, am I right? Come on, Superman, let's get brunch. I'm famished. Monocle is probably evil because he's a full-fledged Nepo baby fail son. All he's missing is the junior at the end of his name. I mean, the guy tricks daddy into seeing his dead wife's ghost, causing reverse hand-to-throat cardiac arrest. Then he pulls out a full purple suit to the funeral. That outfit says, burying my rotten dad is not even my whole day. Solid villain statement. Very convenient that there's a chalkboard embedded into the computer console at the Hall of Justice. Maybe that's where the security system was supposed to go. When all the heroes talked about a guy with a monocle being on the scene, I wish Superman had drawn Mr. Peanut just to mess with him. The final plan by Batman worked out well, although if he had dragged it out longer and allowed Wonder Woman to be sent to a woman's prison, this issue could have turned into a Russ Meyer movie. But I guess Sonny and Cher turning into Trump's hair and a big ocean wave followed by Batman and Robin beating Monocle unconscious was a good plan, too. Oh, dear Lord, Brett. And then finally, Paul Kinn, of course, from this very network as well, says, awesome show as usual, Rob. As always, it's a blast to reread Super Friends and then listen to this show. Russell was a great guest. Glad to hear him on the network again. Hey, Russell, ever have a letter printed at Batman Family or Detective? No under 21 clubs near me growing up, although I have heard of them. But the highlight of the episode was the story of Russell reading Ramona. Cracked me up. Well, thank you, Paul, and thank you, everybody, for the comments. I really do appreciate it. That's going to wrap up this episode of For All Mankind. Huge thanks to Dr. Chris Lewis for stopping by the Hall of Justice, and also big thanks to Chris Franco. We had a lot of Chris's in this episode doing a Ramona Fraiden centric installment of For All Merch Kind. I really appreciate that. It was so much fun, and I learned a lot. Of course, you can find all the episodes of the show on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. We're always talking Super Friends over on Twitter at For All Mankind SF. You can find this podcast on any podcatcher of your choice. And then finally, if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW podcast. And then you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on the show of your choice. So big thanks to Chuck Dill, Stanford M. Brown, Gord Tolton, and David S. Gutierrez for their support of the Fine Water Podcast Network. Really appreciate it. So thanks for listening to For All Mankind. Join us next episode when we will look at Super Friends number 42, How Green Was My Gotham. Yeah.
an FWTV podcast.